Welcome to the AR Show, where I dive deep into augmented reality with a focus on the technology and uses of smart glasses and the people behind them. I'm your host, Jason McDowell. Today's conversation is with Mike Boland. Mike is the founder and chief analyst of Artillery Intelligence, editor of AR Insider, lead analyst of Street Fight, and president of the San Francisco chapter of the VR-AR Association. Earlier in his career, Mike was one of Silicon Valley's first tech reporters focused on the internet as a staff reporter for Forbes magazine starting in the year 2000. And he's been a tech industry analyst at top-tier research firms since 2005. Mike is a frequent speaker at industry conferences, and he's authored more than 120 market forecasts and in-depth reports on the tech and media landscape, including social, mobile, and AR. He contributes regularly to news sites such as TechCrunch, Business Insider, VentureBeat, and the Huffington Post, and he gets quoted in publications such as The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. Mike is a trusted source and very insightful. That becomes clear in this conversation too. Here, we explore the markets and market forecasts for mobile AR and smart glasses. We talk about Apple's motivations and plans, and we discuss Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Snap, trying to guess where they might be going based on their motivations and past behavior. Mike draws lessons from the smartphone era and applies them to what's happening today and where we'll be in 2023. He recalls it took several years for truly native thinking to emerge.
I think the product design is an interesting thread too, because, you know, in that early period, just like we often forget that first, you know, year didn't have apps, we also forget that it took like maybe 2 to 3 years. So we're talking maybe 2009 to 2010 till we really started to see the like native, true native thinking and killer apps. And the examples I often point to are like Foursquare and Waze, and then probably about a year later, Uber. Like the apps that really took the hardware to heart when they were building it, when they built features that tapped into those unique capabilities of the device, the fact that it has a GPS chip and it has an accelerometer and it knows where you are.
We also get into pass-through video versus optical see-through smart glasses. This was a really fun conversation, and I think you'll love it. As a reminder, you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at our website, thearshow.com. Let's dive in. Mike, I heard that you got locked out of your apartment building recently and a very important day. Do you mind sharing that story?
Yes, I had this kind of grandiose plan to propose to my wife. This is about a little over a year ago. It was like last February. And for context, we live here in San Francisco. And before I moved in with her, we had two separate apartments that were, you know, 3-4 blocks away. And I had this grandiose plan to kind of go up to her roof, right? And propose on a roof here in San Francisco. We have beautiful kind of vistas on the roof and whatnot. And my kind of like covert plan was to call her from the roof. First, I had to kind of sneak in. I have a spare key to her building, go up the stairs, set everything up, and then call her under the guise of still being back at my apartment saying, sorry, it's taking me so long. But by the way, while you're waiting for me, go up to your roof. There's like a crazy sunset you just got to see. And then the plan is once she goes up there, I'm standing there with a tuxedo on and, you know, champagne and music playing and, you know, pop the question, et cetera, et cetera. So in order to do this, though, I'm kind of walking over to her apartment and I didn't want to run into her in the hallway. So I had to have this like tuxedo. I had tuxedo pants on under my jeans. And the rest of all this kind of accoutrement, you know, portable speaker, bottle of champagne, et cetera, in this duffel bag. And it's a hot day and I'm walking over there and my heart's pounding as I'm kind of like walking through these steps preemptively in my head. And then I get there and the door won't open. The front door to her building, again, using my spare key, won't open. It turns out that the locks on her building had been changed that week, unbeknownst to me. So I'm sitting there thinking, what's going on? Is this some sort of sign? Is it like my plan is foiled? I'm sweating, heart pounding. I have this very bizarre outfit on with tuxedo pants under my jeans. People are walking by. It looks super shady as I'm just sitting there nervously trying to open this door. So finally, I'm thinking after about 5 minutes of this, like, you know, heart pounding, you know, moment, I realize like maybe I'm just having a senior moment. And I try a different key on the keychain. Maybe I'm just kind of like just so nervous with all these things in my head. I'm just putting the wrong key in. It's the wrong key on the keychain. So I put in my apartment key. So my apartment 3 blocks away, this apartment I've had for 10 years, that key for my apartment door, stick it in the door and it opens the door. So I'm thinking
your key opens her door.
My key opens her door. So I'm thinking, I don't know what just happened, but I don't care. I just need to proceed with the mission, right? So I proceed with the mission. It goes great. She said yes, happy ending, all of that. I guess that should be the climax of the story, but it's not. So anyway, after all this happens, I go, like, what just happened? I couldn't get in the door. And she said, well, you know, the locks have been changed. And I made her come down with me and say, look, I'm not crazy. This is my key. It's opening this door. And I'm thinking, what just happened? I don't know. Is this a sign? It's crazy. And I kind of put it out of my head because then, you know, on to bigger and better things, lots of celebration, you know, champagne popping, etc. But the next day I kind of returned to this, you know, scenario and this kind of statistical anomaly. And I started to research it. And this was like a perfect thing for me to research because this is kind of what I do in terms of like the rigor I put into market sizing and statistics. But also I used to work in the lock aisle at Home Depot. So I know the inner workings of locks. And that was just back in my days in college when I kind of worked a lot of construction and worked at Home Depot during the winters. And I kind of did the math and I did some fact checking with the lock company, which is Schlage. And I found out the odds of any key opening a door other than your own. Do you want to guess what the odds are?
It's, I would say, it depends on the quality of the lock. Like in Europe, they have some crazy secure locks, which is probably ones in millions. But in the US, they're not that sophisticated.
This is a standardized lock. There are kind of just a few different brands. So it's a standardized lock. So I'll just tell you, the odds are 70,000 to 1.
70,000 to 1.
Yeah.
Now, you really won the lottery that day. Your key happened to open the other lock.
Now this the odds can change slightly based on a few different variables, such as location, because the way they ship locks in certain kind of like shipments, there can be a higher chance based on being in the same neighborhood, which I was. But I think that is counteracted by the fact of time, or the factor of time, which is, again, this lock on my door had been put in about 10 years ago. The lock in her door, as I said, had been changed that week. So anyway, just crazy statistics, crazy odds, and it was just one of those things. For someone who spends a lot of time looking at probability and statistics, something personally happened to me that was really just kind of a huge anomaly.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations on
the
marriage. One year in, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, it's awesome that you felt so compelled to go and research. What are the odds of this actually happening? I think in that moment, my mind would have been so flustered, I would have wondered whether I was at my own apartment building and then started walking away, just thinking, oh, I must be in the wrong place. That's pretty amazing. You went back and researched that. And that really kind of fits, as you noted, with your own proclivity to go and research and really understand what are the odds, where are things really going. How is it that you became an analyst?
So I actually started my career as a tech journalist. I was a reporter at Forbes magazine for the print magazine, working at their Silicon Valley bureau here just outside of San Francisco. And that was right around the time of the kind of dot-com boom and bust. And I actually got kind of lucky with the timing because at the time I started as an intern. And that's when really it hit the fan in terms of some of the recessionary economics taking over and the bubble bursting in these parts. So there were rounds and rounds of layoffs throughout the valley. And there's a trickle-down effect in terms of the way that magazines operate and any journalistic operation where you have an ad-to-edit ratio. The amount of editorial pages you write are a function of the amount of ads you're getting. And there's roughly a 50-50 ratio. So there's this kind of trailing indicator with publications as a business that as advertising dries up, those editorial pages go down and therefore they kind of staff up or staff down. Now, I survived many rounds of layoffs, not because I was such a talented young intern, but because I was making almost nothing and was willing to do almost anything. So I kind of survived many rounds of layoffs and kind of then escalated sooner than you normally would to the position of reporter, and really just had an influential period during that time of like just loving it, becoming this kind of industry watcher whose job is to kind of break down these complicated subjects and then kind of parse them and communicate them back through either written narratives or different forms of multimedia. So I really fell in love with that kind of job description. And eventually they laid off the entire Silicon Valley bureau. So I didn't survive that round of layoffs. And I realized I started to see the writing on the wall in terms of the business models that underlie print journalism. And I decided to make the shift over to the analyst corps. And, you know, I had spent a lot of time as a journalist calling analysts to get a quote. You always want to have like a third party objective perspective that you quote in your article. It's kind of just journalism 101. But I would always talk to these guys and say, like, how did you get into that? That seems like a cool job. And it turns out that the skill set is highly transferable between journalist and analyst. So I made that shift. And
what is that skill set?
That's a good question. So there are lots of different types of analysts. Some of them come from industry and do a lot of like client handholding, direct client, high touch work. And some of them do a lot of publishing and market sizing and like time on stage at conferences. And that was the part that I loved, like publishing reports, kind of scratching that writing itch all the time, and just explaining, you know, topics of emerging technology, whether it be to an audience, or to a client, or like moderating a panel on stage. All of those kind of things involve that like kind of intellectual curiosity that I think drives good journalists and reporters. And I think it's the same skill set that makes good analysts. And I tell analysts all the times in analyst firms, you know, they tend to hire like young talent that are like marketing majors. I always tell them hire journalism school students because one, they have that skill set, they have that rigor, they have that drive. And then number two, they're a lot cheaper. they're not expecting high salaries when they go into journalism school. So I think it's a highly transferable skill set. So I kind of fortunately stumbled into that by having some lucky breaks in terms of having Forbes on my resume, in terms of kind of moving into the analyst corps and then just loving it and working hard to, you know, kind of move my way up.
Very nice. And at that time, you were really focused on what was hot and exciting, which was mobile.
Yeah.
And mobile software stuff.
That's another kind of fortunate thing that happened to me in terms of the timing. The firm I was working at, I was by far the kind of youngest analyst, and a lot of the kind of more seasoned analysts were very kind of comfortable in their coverage area. So as an analyst, you have kind of like a specialty, the thing you cover and you zero in on and you kind of just know it back and forth. And I was working for a firm that essentially covered all different forms of media and media and advertising. So we had analysts that covered the television space and radio, and our clients were broadcasters and advertisers and the folks that kind of, you know, make up that ecosystem of ad buying and selling in ad supported media. So they were all kind of covering some of those other forms of traditional media. And no one wanted to, you know, sign up to be the mobile analyst because it was a long learning curve to really just know it inside and out. But again, that goes back to that kind of repertorial intellectual curiosity that I loved. So I signed up for it right away and loved it. And then it was kind of fortunate that that ended up being the right horse to pick, given that like a year later, the iPhone came out and then things just went into hyperdrive in terms of mobile being the touch point in terms of like user engagement and the, you know, as a corollary to that, the place where a lot of development was happening among media companies, among app developers, among advertisers, and all the focus just kind of shifted there. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, it didn't happen that quickly, because we often forget that when the iPhone came out in 2007, the kind of high penetration levels didn't happen until about 3 years later. And it wasn't until a year later in 2008 that there was even an app store. We often forget that first year, 2007 to 2008, the apps we had were those first like 16 native apps that kind of shipped with the phone.
To kind of extend that piece, Steve Jobs not only didn't have apps on that first version of the iPhone, he didn't want apps on the iPhone.
Yeah.
He went out and said, you don't need apps.
Yep.
What we give you is all you need. You got the browser. You can do whatever you need in the browser. You don't need an app store. And then a year later came out and said, by the way, there's this amazing thing. It's the App Store. It'll change your life.
Yeah. And I think that's, we'll probably get into this eventually, but a lesson in kind of the stepping into new areas and, you know, seeing what sticks in terms of consumer traction. And you don't know at the onset. And I think we're kind of seeing that replayed in a lot of ways.
Here we are in the augmented and virtual reality. How is it that you end up making that jump now from mobile to AR? And why is now the right time to be really focusing on the augmented reality space?
Yeah. So what happened there was, you know, having been through that revolution, and again, in a way that I just kind of like thank not any sort of like skill, but mostly luck and timing and everything in terms of being the mobile analyst, I was very, I guess, inspired by having been an industry analyst throughout that revolutionary period in tech and media, and just kind of hungry for it again. So really trying to position myself to be there when the next one comes along or even earlier. So around, I would say, late 2016, I started to get really excited about AR. And I had been actually covering AR as a component to my mobile coverage, a very small component, for a few years in terms of what some of the early leaders like Layar and Blipar and others were already starting to do. But I think that the kind of fever pitch really started to escalate around 2016 as really a corollary to the excitement around VR and Facebook buying Oculus and that kind of just herd mentality when we were all really starting to get excited about it. So what I did was I guess, again, because I was so inspired by having been a part of that mobile revolution, you know, albeit on the sidelines, but a part of it in terms of covering it, I quit my high-paying analyst job and decided to launch Artillery Intelligence, and that happened in early 2017, along with its kind of sister publication, AR Insider.
Hmm. We'll get into more of those in a little bit, but we were just talking about mobile and how you were there, 2006, I guess you're kind of really getting into it. Mm-hmm. It was a very complex landscape in 2006. There were a lot of players who looked like they were potentially going to be dominant. Microsoft was really doing well. Nokia was doing really well. RIM was doing really well, relatively speaking. And then iPhone comes out and it was, you know, poo-pooed by every other major mobile player at the time and considered a non-factor. And from anybody who obsessed over spec sheets, they looked at the Apple phone and they were generally unimpressed.
Yeah.
But Apple clearly had tapped into something that wasn't that maybe as spec worthy, but certainly resonated much more with the users and how they actually wanted to use a mobile computer in their pocket. But as you compare those early days in mobile to where we are today with augmented reality, what are the similarities?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of similarities, and one of them goes back to kind of what we were just talking about, where Steve Jobs kind of retracted on his position of, you know, this is the device that you're going to be using primarily the browser. You know, apps ended up being a great call for them, but at first his intuition was this is going to be a browser-based experience. But then after a while, it became evident, and it required that kind of experimentation, time in market, for that to become evident, and then course correct. I think we're at that stage right now with AR and probably VR too, in terms of feeling that feeling out process of what is going to resonate with consumers, one, but also in the product design. I think the product design is an interesting thread too, because, you know, in that early period, just like we often forget that first, you know, year didn't have apps. We also forget that it took like maybe 2 to 3 years. So we're talking maybe 2009 to 2010 till we really started to see the like native, true native thinking and killer apps. And the examples I often point to are like Foursquare and Waze. And then probably about a year later, Uber, like the apps that really took the hardware to heart when they were building it, when they built features that tapped into those unique capabilities of the device, the fact that it has a GPS chip and it has an accelerometer and it knows where you are. You know, for example, like you couldn't build Uber on the desktop. It just wouldn't make any sense. But in that first 3 years of app development, there were all kinds of things that were just in that non-native desktop way of thinking, let's put it on a smaller screen. And I think that applying that to today is interesting and in some ways encouraging, because I think a lot of people are pointing at AR and saying like, where's the killer app? How come there's no killer app? You know, no killer app. Everyone just keeps saying that. And my thought is that it takes that time period. And if we go by that historical comparison, it was 2 to 3 years. So if we count 2 to 3 years forward from, let's say, the June 2017 launch of ARKit, you know, 3 years past that, and it was actually not until September that the ARKit was available. I think it was, you know, it was available as a developer platform to developers between that period. But anyway, let's say June 2017. 3 years from there is June 2020. So I think if we don't see killer apps, you know, at that point or after, then we can start to worry. But I think that it's that feeling out process, and I think that's a key similarity between now and that early mobile period.
I'm going to challenge that a little bit and suggest it's a lot more than just 3 years.
Sure.
Because we had mobile devices in people's pockets, especially in enterprise sorts of settings for almost a decade prior to when the iPhone came out. You know, late 90s, Nokia has some high-end smartphone-esque things. We had the Treo and Palm and all these other devices early that they had a lot of elements of what the smartphone became. In that entire time, that nearly decade period, it was still this, how do we cram the desktop app into the mobile device?
True. And part of that may be because those were closed systems. It wasn't an open developer platform. Like, in order to build for like Windows Mobile or for RIM, you know, it was kind of more of a handshake, you know, get in with the platform as opposed to just picking up the SDK and building something. So that, like, I think decentralization, probably like just in a pure numbers game, resulted in maybe like a faster period of innovation for that 3-year period for someone to come up with something, because the base there was, you know, hundreds of thousands of developers rather than, you know, hundreds.
Yeah, definitely contributing. I think the other thing that Apple introduced that took a while for people to really appreciate was the difference in how you interact with the device.
Yeah.
Outside of the fact that it was a mobile computer in your pocket that had GPS.
Apple and touch.
And it was the touch interface. The fact that you put your big stubby finger on that device and you could use that instead of finding some stylus and trying to remember, basically treating the stylus like a mouse pointer and navigating around.
And we had touch, but not that capacitive touch where you could actually have like inertia to the movement and all that kind of thing. So I think that that underlying hardware, now that that was available and could be developed upon, then just inspired people to do new things with it. And things, it's notable that like Steve Jobs and the creators of the device like probably hadn't envisioned. So it's almost like this handoff of, we get super innovative with the hardware, now you take it and be super innovative with the software that will work on it, and that kind of open approach, which is not a new, you know, insight, but something that I think they did differently at that time.
Yeah. As I look at kind of the ARKit launch, AR Core launch, we're now just about 2 years into ARKit. If I look at, draw the parallel, like, it was really the user experience with the device that was one of the key kind of gating factors. Once it was unlocked, we were able to truly experiment and then find out what's good. Mm-hmm. Now people would use it. It's not clear to me that we've kind of figured out what the right sort of user interface, user experience paradigm is, even for mobile AR. We definitely haven't figured it out for smart glasses. We're not even close. But even in mobile AR, even there, I see some experimentation about how do we now interact with this idea that the thing we're creating is spatial, or the thing we're interacting with is spatial, but I'm doing so through this little 2D screen. It's still a little bit awkward. So it'll be fun to experiment. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the other areas where we see some actual engagement right now. But I will not be surprised to see several more years of experimentation before we have something truly engaging and inspiring that is AR first and not just an add-on to some other popular app.
And that'll continue to go. It's an iterative process. We still see that for just kind of, you know, apps. So once, if we do see like a killer app, if we're lucky enough to get that in AR, I think it won't be like game over then. It's going to continue to be an iterative process. That might be an inflection point, but I think that educational kind of process for developers and that native footing just kind of keeps going.
Yeah. As you kind of study the difference between what happened in that cycle versus the beginning stages of this particular cycle, what are the notable differences? Like, how are things meaningfully different this time around?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess, you know, when we're talking about mobile AR, it seems that like it was a harder hill to climb then, ironically, because it was a hardware replacement cycle. Mobile AR today piggybacks on an existing install base of a very ubiquitous device. Now with smart glasses, and then when we get over to VR with VR HMDs, that's a different story, because that's obviously going to be a hardware replacement cycle and a new use case and a lot of education. I think that's why in VR there's some challenges in terms of consumer traction. There's also some kind of pricing economics there. But when, with respect to just mobile AR, if we zero in on that, in those early days of smartphones, in terms of like a new thing that had to cycle in, because it's hardware, because it's like atoms that are, you know, devices being shipped, that was actually a harder thing to do in terms of cycling it into ubiquity. And again, that took a few years before it was like, you know, everyone had an iPhone.
Yeah. As you apply those lessons to the hardware in this cycle, the smart glasses or even VR, what are the kind of key differences that might suggest that this cycle will play out differently than the last one?
I think that like the smartphone proved itself to be so inexpendable. You know, it was a communication device. It was something that really kind of built on something that we already kind of had and needed, which was to communicate. You know, something like VR, I put it in less of a like urgent bucket and more of something that is about entertainment. So it's kind of under the entertainment umbrella. So I think that'll make it have a harder kind of road to ubiquity as opposed to something that is an everyday utility. I think the other challenge with VR, and I think we could probably put AR glasses in the same bucket, is, as I mentioned, pricing. If you look at just kind of the behavioral economics of you know, consumer product pricing, and you look at like the amount of things that are ubiquitous that are over $500, let's say, it's a pretty small club. I mean, you have like your car, of course, well over a 500, but you have your car, you have your phone, your flat screen TV, your refrigerator, you know, a few other things. So to get on that list, you know, it has to be something that is, as I said, just an inexpendable product as opposed to something that is an entertainment device. So I think for VR to get there, one of two things need to happen. It needs to kind of dip under that kind of pricing threshold, where you get into kind of the range of like giftable products that have less pricing barriers. I think Oculus Go certainly is there already. Or VR has to prove itself as being something that is, you know, inexpendable to people's lives. And for that to happen, I think it still needs to answer the question of why you buy it. I think there are lots of little answers to that question. You know, some people love Rec Room, some people love Beat Saber, but there isn't just like one big answer for like the mainstream public of like compelling them to buy a VR headset yet. So I think it either has to find a killer app or come down below that, you know, $300 to $400 price range where demand inflects, or both those things.
Yeah, it'll be pretty interesting on the price side.
Yeah.
On that list of things you'd mentioned, TV is entertainment oriented.
Oh, it is. Yeah, that's a good point.
The monitor on your computer, which I guess you probably don't spend more than $500 on the monitor typically, unless you're in design and need a super high end monitor, or have however many $1,000 that you need to, you know, buy this new Apple monitor that they just announced, where the stand by itself was $1,000.
Yeah, the stand. Yeah.
Craziness. Speaking of Apple, when do you think they weighed in on whether it's VR or AR?
So when will kind of Apple enter the market with a spatial computing product?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that, you know, a lot of people are and have been pointing to 2020 as like the magic year. I find that hard to believe in terms of two things. One, like the underlying state of the technology. You know, Apple can work magic, but I don't think they can like defy gravity in terms of just like advancing the underlying technology like 2 to 3 years to where it needs to be, you know, before everyone else. And Apple, besides that challenge, and again, this is like 2020, 6 months away, besides that challenge, there are two things that Apple does where an AR headset coming out next year would be kind of against its MO. One of which is that it is highly kind of design and industrial design oriented. And the state of the technology now to build something that is compelling enough in a UX, but yet sleek enough in to pass that kind of Apple style test, I think is highly challenging. And then, but I think the bigger reason is that Apple does not come to market first. Apple with its hardware products will generally enter late and just kind of blow everyone else out of the water. I think you could argue that they were, you know, they bucked that trend with the iPhone and the iPad, where they were kind of the category definers. But as you pointed out, if you broaden back to just like smartphone, not necessarily a touchscreen smartphone, but smartphones, there were a lot of products already on the market, all the ones we already named. So I think that they do come to the market late. And it just seems early, you know, when I just kind of like ask myself if that's it within Apple's MO, it seems early for them. So what we're predicting is 2021 for an announcement. And that's also good to delineate like the quarters of the year. Apple usually announces new hardware in the fall. It is kind of September hardware event. We believe that could happen in September 2021 with a device shipping midway through the following year, 2022.
Hmm. So 2022 is the key year for when Apple hardware
for when they'll be in our hands.
In our hands.
Not announced.
No, that's right. And that's V1 of whatever that device happens to be.
Yes.
As you project forward several years, what happens to the iPhone? How does that device fit in? It's a huge moneymaker for Apple. There's been a lot of news about how, you know, smartphone sales are plateauing and revenue might still be growing, but the units aren't growing. And so Apple is potentially gearing up to have this next wave of some sort of personal computing where they can be a major player. And maybe that the pressure that they feel from the market, the iPhone sales are stagnating and they don't have the next big thing just yet.
Yeah.
Maybe that motivates them to move a little bit earlier than they would otherwise. I don't know. Regardless, though, they have this device that everybody has in their pocket already and they continue to sell a ton of them. What happens to that device as they release their spatial computing glasses?
Yeah, I think that's the key point. It's the level of motivation for Apple. I think that motivation's a big thing there. But first of all, stepping back, I think AR is going to have like a few different kind of vectors with Apple. One of which is during this period where, as you rightly point out, quarter over quarter, iPhone sales are decelerating, and it's not just iPhone. We're reaching kind of market saturation for smartphones. They are trying to kind of boost sales through kind of making the iPhone sexy again, more things that happen on the device, more justifications for the escalating price. They are counterbalancing some of those unit sales decline that you mentioned with a higher price tag. And to justify that, it's just kind of more features. It's the feature set of the phone. So I think one, AR's job is to make the iPhone sexy again. Number two, that through ARKit, what they want to do is plant the seeds for their longer term play, which is likely glasses. And we can circle back to that in a second. But by seeding that with a development platform on the developer side, they are jumpstarting that process we talked about earlier of developers gaining their native footing, getting used to the idea, wrapping their heads around this kind of spatial experience interface. And they want to get that ball rolling so that that's kind of in place for when, you know, the succession plan kicks in, as you alluded to, the succession plan being potentially these glasses. And that's a device that is at a younger stage of its lifespan. So its kind of unit growth, its revenue growth can really ramp up faster. And I think you brought up another key point in terms of where the iPhone fits into that world. So I think that, you know, if we look at the potential model for what that device will look like, it'll likely be iPhone tethered. Sort of like what you see with the Enreal Light glasses, where you can either get a processing unit or you can bring your own device if it has a Snapdragon 835 chip or greater. That makes a lot of sense for iPhone because one, it increases the reliance on the iPhone. If that's the device you already have in your pocket, Apple will have a lighter bill of goods. In terms of building the device, they can pass that savings on to consumers where the processing, the GPU, the CPU, some of the other kind of sensors are in the tethered device. That one makes them build a device that can be cheaper and lighter in the actual glasses frames themselves. But number two, it increases the reliance on the iPhone and extends the lifespan of the iPhone because it now becomes that much more important because it is like the brains of your, you know, smart glasses.
Yeah. So the phone then is the local compute. It's still the communication device. It's connected to the broader internet, connected to the glasses. They have a huge investment in their audio with the AirPods. They have a big investment in Apple Watch. Do those, all of those devices kind of come together to form this constellation of devices that Apple wants to sell you?
Yeah, constellation is the right way to put it. I mean, I think absolutely. So, you know, we talk about glasses being this succession plan. It's not just the glasses. I think it's like this holistic suite of wearables where you have like line of sight graphical annotations with the glasses. You can have like biometric tracking and information delivered to your wrist with watch. I think that AirPods are like a really kind of interesting like dark horse or wild card in this whole equation. Because the hardware penetration has quietly just like ramped up. I think they sold 40 million of them last year. And the interesting thing there is that that's what comes first is conditioning that hardware use case, especially when one of the challenges with wearables and especially kind of AR glasses is projected to be, you know, will people put them on their face? Like, will people wear them? And I think they've answered that question, that key question in terms of the hardware conditioning with AirPods. And I think that could be the gateway towards then delivering experiences and perhaps even opening it up to a larger developer community to build experiences that are based on an audible delivery of information, like a subtle whisper in your ear that tells you kind of useful stuff throughout your day. You know, you could picture apps from LinkedIn that tells you, you know, someone's name that you are shaking hands with at a conference. Or, you know, social apps and navigation apps and all kinds of things with that just subtle whisper in your ear. And its discreteness, I think, sidesteps a lot of those style crimes that are, you know, going to be a challenge with glasses.
Yeah. As you're saying that, I'm imagining that there is a potential path of rollout where ARKit in the phone combined with AirPods that have IMU in them, like the ability to understand what orientation your head is in.
Yeah, where your head turns and everything, yep.
Could be that next increment of augmented reality experiences without the need of glasses. And then from there, you can add glasses, but maybe they're regular glasses without display.
Yeah.
They replicate maybe the audio component, or maybe they just simply have a camera capture component. As we think back to Snap Spectacles, that sort of use case. And the primary use case for Google Glass is really the fact that there's a camera on it. You can capture very quickly anything that's in front of you. And they can kick this can down the road. I'm just kind of imagining, how can Apple kick down the can while still claiming continuous progress and demonstrating continuous progress towards creating this next wave of personal compute around augmented reality, spatial computing?
And we talked about Apple's MO. Another thing that Apple does is they like lock-in. They like locking you into an ecosystem. And when you have the situation where there are three different devices, glasses, watch, hearables, where the whole is greater than the sum of their parts in terms of like, hey, if you have all three, you can do X, Y, Z. If you only have two, it's kind of cool. So that like incentive to get all three is very much in the kind of like ARPU, average revenue per user, like metrics that Apple loves.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to kind of the comparison between what happened in the smartphone era versus what might happen here going forward for smart glasses, when I look at some analyst reports, such as Digital Capital or Superdata and others, there's a couple of key assumptions that go into these reports. Everybody shows things going up and to the right, like this exponential growth is going to happen under this belief that it is the next personal compute platform. But often one of the key assumptions is, when is Apple actually going to release a pair of glasses? And when that happens, that's when the hockey stick really starts to happen. How do you think Apple's timing affects those forecasts? And when they do release, is it really going to be an immediate hockey stick, or is it still going to be kind of a slow growth?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it will have an impact. Like, everyone's charts have that like inflection point where it's probably sometime around 2021 or 2022. And that inflection point is largely because of the projection of these glasses being released. And I think that, you know, when we do our kind of methodology for market sizing, we do it in a bottom-up approach, which requires looking at all of the different ways that hardware is bought and sold, who's buying what, what's the unit price. It's a lot of unit economics that you build up, as opposed to saying like, well, this market I think will grow by 28%, so therefore I'm just going to apply it across the board. Like, it's a much more involved way of doing it. And I can't speak to the methodologies of other firms. I think it's best practices to do that. They're probably doing that same thing, that bottom-up approach. Top-down is good as like a gut check. Like, does this follow the overall industry growth that we could expect from historical comparisons and other things? But anyway, back to your question. When you do that bottom-up approach, there's lots of different components. Like, when we say AR and VR are growing to like X number of dollars by 2023, that's divided into VR, AR, and then it subdivides into consumer, enterprise, and that subdivides into hardware, software, and all these things. So the degree to which Apple Glasses will impact the number is huge within one of those slices, which is consumer hardware revenues. If you kind of just throw that back in and add everything up with all those other subsectors, the overall number isn't impacted as much, at least in early years, because, you know, we project them selling in their first year, probably like 2 to 3 million units. You know, it's not going to be 20 million units. And there's kind of this, it's going to take a while to build up. There's this kind of magic number I always go to when it comes to hardware sales, which is 100 million. Once you pass 100 million, there becomes this kind of flywheel effect where there is incentive for developers and content creators to kind of pay attention to and build for those platforms. Then there's more content on those platforms in that device. So therefore, it becomes a more attractive consumer purchase. And then increased levels of consumer then further incentivize developers, and it's that just kind of virtuous cycle. And then the path to 200 million is a lot faster, and it just accelerates. So I believe that the first few years of Apple Glasses are still going to be a tough climb, even though there will be, you know, that Apple halo effect that I think is important and will impact some of the other subsectors of AR, because people will kind of, it will be more friendly to the mainstream and more of a curious thing they want to check out. Apple has a track record of having that halo effect. But I think in early days, it's really not going to have a huge impact in terms of just like the unit sales going, you know, anywhere over a few million units.
And that 100 million number that you mentioned, that's total installed base, or is that per year sales?
That's a great question. It's installed base. And once you have a device in market for a little while, if it's like a 3-year replacement cycle, you can get to an installed base faster. Like, the fourth year, you'll get to it faster than like the third to the fourth to the fifth.
Sure.
And absolutely, I think that's a good distinction. It's installed base. And by the way, one of the examples for that 100 million number was that's kind of what happened in the smartphone world. Like things really started to take off and they went from 100 million to 200 million a lot faster because of that kind of flywheel effect.
Hmm. Are there other key assumptions that are really worth noting as you think about the forecast over the next couple of years?
Yeah. So, and in forecasting, back to some of the methodology points, there's a lot of assumptions, educated assumptions that goes into like the outer year numbers. The key and the science to getting forecasts as tight as you can get them is to nail the current period and just kind of collect as many inputs as possible in terms of current sales, in terms of, you know, all of these different clues that you have to put together in this big puzzle. You know, what are the sale prices? What are the unit sales? There's just kind of a lot of that unit economics you kind of build up to. And if you can nail that current year, it puts you in the best position to then project forward. So I think that some of those things, some of those X factors in those kind of future projections, there's a couple of them. So one is consumer adoption and when that kind of kicks in, because it's been a lot slower than a lot of us thought in past years. And when I say consumer adoption, I mean people downloading ARKit and ARCore apps or using AR in kind of other platforms. The most use today is coming from things like Facebook Spark AR and Snap's Lens Studio and some web AR and Pokemon Go. But I think that's largely fragmented. And like I said, for VR, there isn't just like one big answer, one killer app that will kind of cause that inflection point. So I think, you know, a killer app or a series of killer apps could really start to accelerate that. And again, that's an X factor in terms of when that's going to happen. I often like to point to historical evidence, like we did earlier in terms of that like 3-year cycle for like something to come out that is, you know, more natively designed. And we bake some of those kind of, I don't know, intuitions into our numbers, because that's all you can do with the kind of future year projections.
Yeah. So given the assessment you have of the current market and where you think we're going to be, looking out to 2025, can you share some of the numbers that you think we're going to be at, maybe in terms of whether it's hardware sales or units installed base for smart glasses? What are some of the key numbers in 2025?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. So our forecasting, usually it's on a 5-year cycle. So like we're working on numbers now that are like 18 to 23.
Okay.
But extrapolating forward based on what we are looking at for 23, the, you know, installed base of, well, let's start with like the smartphone installed base. That's a good place to start, which is now at about 3.2 to 3.3 billion units globally. And as we discussed before, that's reaching saturation and starting to kind of slow. So, you know, out to 2023, we have our overall smartphone projections at about 3.4 billion units. Now, those that are AR compatible is a different story. So AR compatibility is, we often hear the number 1 billion these days, and that's accurate by adding up both AR Core and AR Kit, right? But AR and mobile AR is fragmenting to a great degree. When we say 1 billion, and when a lot of people say 1 billion, they often forget that there are 1.5 billion devices that are compatible with Facebook Spark AR. And when you look at Snap, there are, you know, a lot less because of their global scale. They're largely centered in the US, but they have about 190 million daily active users those devices are compatible with their flavor of AR. So there are all these kind of fragmented platforms, but I think the number that is most important is the deduplicated active users that use AR on at least a monthly basis today. We have that at 302 million today. And we have that growing, again, we project out to 2023, we have that growing to almost 900 million AR active users by 2023. So if you follow that kind of growth curve, if you're asking about 2025, we could crack a billion by 2025.
Great. And that's active
AR, right? Users, yes.
People that developers would get excited about creating, yes, something for, yeah. On the smart glasses side of things, looking to 2023, is any consumer wearing anything in 2023? I guess maybe if Apple starts shipping something in 2022, we can expect at least a couple million. What does that number look like on the smart glasses side?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, we're probably parsing consumer because our overall smartphone penetration we have at about 10 million by 2023.
We're talking smart glasses here or smartphone?
That's smart glasses, 10 million. But a lot of that is in the enterprise.
Got it.
So, but the consumer portion of that, yes, I think we have that at about 3 to 4 million in 2023.
Wonderful. Still a little ways to go to get to, yep. to be a really exciting market for a lot of software developers, but a couple of million is not that far off of where we are today with consumer VR.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You know, VR is ahead in terms of hardware penetration.
Yeah. And so maybe 5 years from now, the smart glasses on the consumer side will be similar to where we are today with VR in terms of penetration. Does that kind of line up a bit with your numbers?
Yeah, I would say that's fair. And the numbers I was citing earlier, the 10 million total, 3 to 4 of which are consumer, that's annual sales. You made the great distinction earlier about, installed base.
Yeah.
Because in VR right now, the annual sales of hardware are last year, it was around 9 million. And that includes a lot of kind of low quality, low cost devices in China. If you were to just segment out the kind of tier one headsets, the Rifts, the Vives, the PSVRs of the world, that's probably closer to about, about 3 to 4 million per year in unit sales. But the installed base at the end of last year, it was around 27 million units for VR. And that includes, again, all device classes and an installed base of, cumulative units in market from the past, 3 to 4 years worth of sales.
Yeah. Does that number include mobile VR as well? It does. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although mobile VR we see that retracting largely because we see the standalone category kind of taking its place as things like Oculus Go are like almost within the same price range as like a Gear VR and just such a better device.
Yeah. Let's shift a little bit here. And at AWE recently, one of the talks you gave on stage was this wonderful insight into what the other major players are doing based on how they've behaved in the past. And it was really about following the money. We talked a bit about Apple already with their MO around the set of ingredients isn't really there yet. Their MO isn't satisfied yet for them to be introducing consumer smart glasses next year. And we talked about the Constellation devices and their approach. If we look at some of the other major players, I'd love to kind of quickly walk through your perspective on, for example, what Microsoft can be expected to do given what they've already done. They may be drawing on what they've got right or wrong last time around with mobile.
Yeah, I'll definitely talk about Microsoft. But first, stepping back for like 30 seconds, this goes back to your point earlier about, what you said Apple is motivated, highly motivated because the iPhone unit sales are decelerating. I think that motivational factor is like a thread across all the other kind of what we call the big five. And when you look at like their motivations for investing in, various points of the spatial computing spectrum, the motivations are all different, but there's one common thread, which is to kind of protect or grow or like pave the future path for their core businesses. And we just went over that with Apple in terms of like, how does this affect the iPhone? How does it boost the iPhone? How does it form a succession plan for the iPhone? So I think that like ingredient exists with all these other players. And the reason why that's important is if we can answer the question of why and what their motivation is, you can kind of triangulate where they're going, which is obviously valuable for like startups in the space and anyone working on product roadmaps and stuff like that. Because the gravitational pull of these folks, they can just pull the market along with them. But anyway, you asked about Microsoft. Microsoft's interesting. So Microsoft's kind of core business is enterprise productivity, just like we talked about Apple's core business being selling hardware. And I think that, Apple is doing a lot of smart things in terms of positioning themselves and investing in AR for enterprise productivity. And there's another thread with Microsoft that's interesting, and you alluded to this in terms of things they've done wrong in the past. So throughout the kind of smartphone era, back to that, discussion of like the smartphone lessons, they failed to market a device that was like a direct consumer touch point. And of course, they had Windows Mobile, which is their operating system. And they decided that they were going to go for that kind of traditional Windows approach, where they have a software operating system. They work with various hardware OEMs to kind of bundle that software on the hardware. And it's basically a licensing model. So they decided to take that path with smartphones. But what kind of like screwed over their entire plan was the fact that Google came along and did that same thing, but for free. So Android was free, and that's a loss leader for Google, so they could kind of position themselves in front of mobile users as a really just a corollary to drive their search business. Now, Apple, being a company that makes money from selling software, found it hard to match that price of zero. So essentially what happened was all those OEMs chose Google Android instead of Windows Mobile. So just after all of that, Microsoft ends up without that direct touch point to mobile users, and they just kind of got left out of that smartphone revolution. So this is something that I think they still feel the sting from, and they don't want to happen again. So this kind of area of enterprise productivity and what they've done with the HoloLens in terms of enterprise AR, I think is representative of just owning the stack. Like, they want to own the hardware, they want to own the direct touch point, and they've done a great job in terms of a market leading device in the HoloLens. But then also, like, that full stack approach, which is ironically how its longtime nemesis Apple rose to power through like that hardware software vertical integration, because they have the hardware in HoloLens, they have the operating system in Windows Mixed Reality, they have the app layer, which continues to grow through things like Spatial Anchors and their remote assist program and others like that. It's kind of like the version of Microsoft Office for AR. And then also, they most importantly, they have Azure, which is their, you know, secure cloud data storage, security, delivery kind of engine. And that positions them better than anyone in terms of jumping on this enterprise AR opportunity, because not only do they have all that stack in place, but they know enterprise software sales. They've been doing it for years. They know the sales cycle. They know the cadence. They know what people are looking for. They know the security concerns, and they already have those addressed with things like Azure. So they have that locked down. And I think they're largely unchallenged with that positioning for that kind of large enterprise AR opportunity.
Yeah, it seems that they are taking more of a full stack approach this time around. Although it's not clear to me that this was their comprehensive strategy at the outset.
That's probably true.
But they certainly have leaned into something that makes a lot of sense right now. But when they initially launched the HoloLens, they seem to have had a pretty broad perspective on how it might be used. And there was a lot of consumer bent.
Yes,
into some of the investment that they were making into the content that they wanted to showcase, and games made for it, and both from internal studios at Microsoft as well as external studios. And enterprise was just one of many sorts of potential use cases that they were exploring.
Yep.
And, you know, HoloLens 1 was really a development kit. It was an exploration, an experiment. But with HoloLens 2, they definitely have clearly identified who they're going after, which is the enterprise. That's who's willing to buy today. You noted all the things around. It resonates with what Microsoft has done in the past in terms of how they sell and who they sell to. The sort of the hardware cycle that IT departments are comfortable with, and all the other concerns that IT departments have with any sort of mobile device inside the enterprise. But the question I ask you right now is, given the mistake that they made with mobile, they had the enterprise before with mobile. Anybody who was buying mobile,
that's true,
in 2007 was an enterprise, were buying Windows mobile devices. Once again, they're going to seat themselves very comfortably within the enterprise space. Do they have the DNA to recognize and to execute on a consumer device when the hardware itself is ready for that?
I think that, well, first, the market isn't ready. So one of the reasons they did that pivot, I think they were just experimenting with both consumer and enterprise. They saw, fortunately for them, because it's in their DNA, that enterprise was the path where the revenues are today, whereas consumer, you know, that market is still developing in terms of, you know, any form of AR head-worn AR hardware. So I think that worked out for them. But the question, I guess, is, yeah, like when that consumer market does show up, and when the hardware and the technology gets to be the point where it can be sleek enough that consumers will they then kind of pivot back towards consumer? And that's a good question. I'm not sure. I think that, you know, similar to how Magic Leap is doing that pivot in reverse now, where they're seeing that there's not a large consumer market, so that they're trying to think about how they can enter the enterprise. And they're going to have a challenge doing that, because they don't have all that DNA that Microsoft has in terms of the kind of all the culture and the buying cycles and just the tactics of selling into the enterprise with software. I think in reverse, Microsoft might face that same challenge in that, you know, selling to consumers. I guess you could argue they do have some experience and capacity in selling to consumers, because they've been doing that for years with their software, though it is kind of enterprise first. you know, a lot of us have Microsoft productivity software and the operating system running on our personal PCs. So I think they have, I guess, what it takes to kind of go both routes. But I think their specialty and at least their near-term kind of blitz is going to be the enterprise.
Yeah. As I look at Microsoft and what they've done and what they've created so far, which, as you noted, is really taking a full stack approach to all of the things that go into making AR smart glasses useful, which is not just the hardware, but the hardware they've created, HoloLens 2, is amazing on so many dimensions, that it would not surprise me if they took a Google-like approach into the consumer space for smart glasses, given that they give up the hardware itself, but they own everything else. They own the OS, but they don't care about monetizing the OS. But then they own all of the software stack above that in terms of the cloud services that go into making AR useful. Maybe. We'll see. I think their investment on the Azure side, on the cloud side for AR, is a really important one.
I agree.
Yeah. So as we go down the list of the other players, we just talked about Google. Where do you think they are going, right? They're a very early entrant in AR. They experimented with Google Glass, once again, thinking consumer was ready, and clearly it was not. And they pivoted to enterprise, and they've had some pretty decent success on the enterprise side of things. And they are certainly investing on the mobile phone side with AR Core. And they've got some pretty great engineers there at Google. Yep. Where do you think they're going from here?
Yeah, Google has lots of irons in the fire, like across the kind of spatial computing XR spectrum, all the things you just mentioned. I think the one that's probably most important, because they have AR Core, they have, Daydream, they have Google Glass, which has found its footing in the enterprise. They have Google Lens, they have VPS walking directions. So I think that, we can kind of go over some of those really quickly. Like AR Core, they're going about that for some of the similar reasons that Apple is, in terms of it being a free platform, a loss leader for them to then position them in some way. So for Apple, that's positioned to make the devices sexier and to sell more hardware. For Google, with AR Core, having that operating system planted in more places, just like they did with Android, in terms of just getting in front of more users to then in turn drive their core search business, which is a $100 billion a year business. And that goes back to that kind of underlying point of what are the motivations for all these folks doing this? But beyond AR Core, some of the things that interest me more are at the app layer, like what they're doing with Google Lens. And I've probably been a broken record in terms of the stuff I've been publishing about Google Lens and, how maybe if that's not the killer app, it'll be something that possesses some of those characteristics in being, one, a utility.
To interrupt briefly, Google Lens is visual search. It's the idea of pointing your camera and using the camera as the input to figure out whatever it is you want to find on the internet.
Yeah, I'm glad. Sorry, I should define it exactly. It's hold your phone up, point it at something, and then it tells you what that thing is or contextualize it. It's using computer vision. It's using Google's image recognition database from all of its, library of images. It's using machine learning and it's kind of bringing all those things together. Google's knowledge graph and all that other stuff. So Google, that brings up another point, which is Google is uniquely positioned to do this. Not only are they motivated, but the reason I like Google Lens is it has the potential to be a high frequency use case. It has the potential to be this kind of mundane utility that is something that you just kind of get used to and use throughout your day, sort of like search. But I think that the other thing is Google's motivation is that, there's this misnomer that in the mobile era, in the smartphone era, Google has just made out like a bandit and its search traffic has skyrocketed. And that's actually true to some degree. And over half of its search traffic is now happening on mobile devices. But when you look at the desktop use case versus the mobile use case, on the desktop, more time is spent, more stuff is done through the browser as opposed to apps, and Google is the front door to the browser. Where on mobile devices, Google in early days was kind of sidestepped by Apple's kind of app kind of ecosystem because that Google search bar is not there when you open up every app, as opposed to browser-based experiences. And about 80% of users' time in mobile is spent in apps as opposed to browser. So because of that, Google's been working for years to counterbalance that, because one of Google's key kind of KPIs that leads to its revenue is search query volume. It's all about search query volume and bid pressure and CPCs and click-through rates and cost per click and all that. I won't get into all those unit economics, but the point is that Google's been trying to counterbalance that trend in mobile, where it has kind of been displaced to some degree as that like front door to connected experiences. So there have been a few things it's done to try to do that, to get that search traffic back. One is voice search, Google Assistant. And I see Google Lens as being that next one, where if it can get people to hold up their phone and, you know, it won't apply to all use cases, but you can picture lots of scenarios where pointing your phone at something is easier than typing. And I think that the types of use cases it's going to shine in are ones that Google is particularly interested in, which is commerce-based use cases. You're looking for something to eat on the street, you want to hold up your phone and get the Yelp reviews of that restaurant. Or you're standing in a store aisle and you hold up your phone, get all the information about a given product, comparative pricing, reviews, all of that. And I think that once that consumer behavior is kind of conditioned a little more, it will be, I think, just one of those true utilities. And again, solve Google's motivation of just getting in front of people more often for more kind of search traffic. And I say search traffic to compare it to the traditional form of people typing things in. But in this case, it's a visual search instead of a typed one.
Yeah. I think to kind of extend on that, you talked about commerce for Google being kind of a key motivator and driver. They're going to be trying to insert themselves into every transaction that they can. And so often, like I was just thinking about the Walmart app has now been enhanced with some visual search as well.
They do have.
So when you're staring inside the Walmart store at a particular item, they'll bring up online reviews and other relevant information to help you make a choice about the product you're standing in front of right there.
And for Google, this is a holy grail because Google has always been positioned several steps away from offline transactions. So if you're talking about an online transaction, it's easy for them to measure a click stream. And if it ends in like some sort of e-commerce, you know, based transaction, they can tell that advertiser, look, you know, the search someone did ended up at your site and we can just tell the click stream. They can't do that as well if you end up like 2 days later buying something at Walmart. So that gap that exists between online search and offline transactions has been this holy grail for them to figure out, particularly based on the scale. Like when you look at e-commerce, only about 10% of US retail spending happens on e-commerce. The rest, the vast majority, all happens offline. So if Google can connect those dots between online and offline, it's been trying to do that for years. So if it can be that search entity at the store aisle, I think it'll be very happy.
One of the other ways that they're trying to connect that online and offline is in the Maps app.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah, they are basically slowly taking over Yelp, right? The Yelp functionality is now inside of Google Maps.
Yeah.
you have all the store information, reviews, everything is happening now inside Google Maps. And I find that my own user behavior is that I go to Yelp far less often. I just go to Google Maps and I'll search for something that I want in that particular area. I'll do the reviews based on what Google has and their reviews. And they're getting more and more involved in that particular transaction and connecting from the online to the offline.
Yeah. And this is something in the SEO world, like just the online search engine optimization world, that has been a very controversial issue for years, where Google is slowly taking over, you know, and the folks that used to get search traffic, Yelp being one of them, Yelp has been one of the loudest. They're actually trying to fight this on like on legislative levels. They are trying to claim that Google has this monopoly power because it has so much search traffic and it's starting to put its own results, i.e. the knowledge graph and the knowledge panel. You know how when you search, sometimes you see like Google's own results.
Right, like I'm searching for a flight, particular flight, see what time's coming in. Google gives me the response or the stocks or whatever. Yeah.
And you know, United Airlines used to get that, you know, result number one, or Yelp used to get result number one when you searched for a given restaurant, and now they're kind of pushed down. So Google is definitely... it's going to happen, I think, in visual search, but it's already been happening in their traditional search, more and more kind of taking over the result set.
Yeah. Let's shift to Facebook.
Sure.
Another major player. They've announced last year that they're working on AR smart glasses. So they spent a bunch of money on VR with the acquisition of Oculus. They got a bunch of super smart people working on all sorts of things related to spatial computing, including with the Snap. Or the, not Snap, they're certainly copying a lot from Snap, but they're doing their own stuff inside of in Facebook and in Lenses, et cetera. How do you think, based on their past behavior, they're going to participate in the market? What's their approach?
Yeah. So I think, like we talked about with Apple, there's like long and short term kind of AR and VR plays that really do kind of play off each other. But in the short term, you know, Facebook's kind of business is based on that kind of walled garden and keeping people within that walled garden as long as possible. So they've been able to prove that AR lenses, just, you know, fun AR lenses that you share with people, you know, rainbow vomit or dog ears or what have you, kind of keeps people engaged longer, where they can then just kind of increase their average revenue per user in terms of time spent there, ads served, etc. But also beyond that, just like keeping their people there longer, they've also started to realize that this is a format that's very conducive to advertising, and advertisers are loving it in terms of like demonstrating product attributes in very immersive ways, whether that be like a front-facing camera activation of like cosmetics try-ons or sunglasses or style items, or even what they're getting into more and more, which is the rear-facing camera activation of, you know, putting things in your space. So it's kind of this rare full funnel ad medium that advertisers are really starting to like, because they can reach people at scale. So that's the top of the consideration funnel, but then also the bottom of the funnel, which is that direct response, actually selling things. The fact that it's so immersive and people are trying things on, and then you can take the additional step to then just like buy that pair of sunglasses, is that it's just a rare kind of full funnel ad medium. Advertisers are loving it. So for all those reasons, it's just kind of fitting right into Facebook's advertising business model. And then long-term, I'll mention briefly, because you mentioned, you know, the interplay of AR and VR and their vested interest in VR. Michael Abrash, who is the former Oculus CTO, now is Facebook, what are they calling it now? Facebook Reality Studios, whatever the Oculus entity now within Facebook is, he's still the CTO. But anyway, he gives this great speech every year at the Oculus Connect conference. And one thing he likes to talk about is how their work in AR is actually going to help them get to VR faster, because they share a lot of the same technological underpinnings in terms of, you know, mapping and graphical processing and all of that. So I think that that's going to converge a lot for Facebook and just help them solve a lot of those sticky problems in AR, will help them just be that much more astute at developing VR products.
Yeah, I honestly love whenever he gets up on stage and talks about,
he's good, huh?
AR. He does such a brilliant job of breaking down the many technical challenges to making a great AR smart glass sort of experience. And they are, from what I have seen, taking a very long-term perspective when it comes to the hardware itself and the potential for the market. This isn't a, it needs to work in the next year or two or we're out. They seem to be taking a much longer-term, 5-10 year sort of perspective on what needs to be done.
Absolutely.
As they build it out. Which, on the one hand, I'm super excited about. I love having somebody with such deep pockets and such tremendously great engineers working on solving these very hard problems. On the other hand, Facebook and their tendency to monetize your attention, you know, directly through ads, makes me a little bit concerned about what that end experience is ultimately going to be on the software side of things.
They're going to be haunted forever by their ad revenue model and their, at least if not real, perceived conflict in data collection. And it probably is real, but I mean, that's there. And I think that's on consumers' minds, especially lately. But also there, you mentioned deep pockets and long-term thinking. I think those are great things that we as consumers can benefit from, because I think that, you know, the Oculus Quest being $399 and the Oculus Go being $199 is a result of that long-term investment on their part. And it's a classic loss leader approach where they're subsidizing the hardware to really develop a market, attract developers, attract users, and just kind of get that going faster. And I think we can take advantage of that, because we're getting in like the Quest, for example, a device that, you know, should be a few hundred dollars more.
Yeah, very true. Hmm. Speaking of Quest, do you think that's kind of truly the beginning of VR, like iPhone in some ways was the beginning of smartphones, even though it really wasn't, but in our memories it is. Is Quest the beginning of VR in the same way?
So I have so much respect for Quest, both the fact that what I just said, it's like cheaper, or it's cheaper than it should be. I'm impressed with what they've been able to do in terms of what you would otherwise consider to be a lot of spec compromises. And just kind of they've made it work through just kind of clever software engineering to make things work on that, you know, that Snapdragon chip they're using, which is essentially that, you know, the same thing you find in a mid-range like Android smartphone, and just the way they've made that work. So I don't want to like slam it for anything, but I don't think it's the iPhone, but I think that's a good thing. I think it's encouraging for us. Like if we consider that like the Palm Pilot, you know, on the way, on the evolutionary path towards the iPhone, then I think it's, you know, we have a lot of good things to look forward to, but it is a jump. It is a great evolutionary jump.
In terms of your expectations for sales of the Quest, how many multiples of Oculus Go do you think the Quest sales will be?
Yeah, I've been back and forth over this, because the Quest, you know, so first of all, the Go is like when we do consumer surveys for VR, the price points, or sorry, the demand inflects at the price points of $200 and $400. Those happen to be the exact price points of Go and Quest. I think Go is it's giftable. I actually expected a lot more during the Q4 holiday period of 2018. We don't actually know those numbers because Facebook doesn't disclose them. But you know, that was what I thought would be a moment of truth for whether or not Go is something that is going to catch on in a mainstream way. And we still don't know that. And there's a lot of kind of clues out there that we're looking at. But on to Quest, I think that's interesting too, in that we kind of have those clues that we're looking at. In fact, Oculus has just announced at the Code conference, it was Andrew Bosworth on stage. He mentioned that in 2 weeks, they have sold 5 million in content sales. Which is a nice little clue, because you can do kind of a thought exercise there and do some extrapolation. We haven't published anything on this, but just as a thought exercise, if you consider that the average price of Quest games is probably around $25, we've looked at, you know, all the games available, and it's around $25 as like a median price point. And if you consider that people are buying two games on average, and again, that's a guess, thought exercise, you crunch all those numbers together, and it means that they have sold 100,000 units based on that number that they gave us with, you know, 5 million in content sales. And backing into the hardware sales number, it's about 100,000 units, which is pretty impressive for 2 weeks when you look at the kind of pace of VR hardware sales across the rest of the market. You know, Rift in an entire year is selling closer to maybe 250,000 units. Quest within 2 weeks has reached, you know, almost half that.
Yeah, bodes well, I guess, for the rest of the year.
It does.
In terms of Quest sales. I think the
especially Go, in the holiday Q4 holiday period.
That's right. And I think the Go sold about a million or so last year, a million units. I think that was my off the top of my head.
That was our estimate, and all the things that we were seeing, the evidence was tracking well to that.
Yeah. And so maybe Quest is a multiple of that, maybe 2, 3, 5. We'll see. Over the next 12 months, we'll see.
It could be.
Jumping back to this idea of retail, Walmart, Google trying to insert themselves, the other player, other major kind of, at least in terms of internet, large company internet players who are interested in AR is Amazon.
Of course.
They sell things, a couple of things. that's kind of their shtick, but they also have a bunch of web services, and they're playing with AR in both of those areas. On the web services side, they have Sumerian to help people create AR content. And on the mobile commerce side, they're leveraging AR, and I think which is kind of the third main mobile AR bucket. We talked about social expression with Snap and Facebook. We talked about the idea of games with Pokemon Go. Kind of the third bucket in my mind of where mobile AR is actually being used today is in mobile commerce, e-commerce.
Yep.
And the idea here is that you leverage that mobile device to visualize what that physical object will look like in a real environment, whether it's a table, a couch, or a coffee maker, or whatever. And by visualizing it, the potential benefit is that you're more likely to buy it and less likely to return it because you're making a better choice. And so we see Amazon leveraging mobile AR here as well. But kind of given who they are and what they've done in the past, how do you think they're going to participate in AR? Are they just going to be a consumer of AR technology to help them sell more things? Or are they going to take a broader stance and capture more than what they already do in terms of how they interact with our lives?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think like all the other giants we talked about, there's kind of, you know, many, many shots on goal, many, you know, lines in the water, many irons in the fire, whatever metaphor you want to use. So let's go through some of those you mentioned. So the direct kind of commerce enablement in terms of a tool to, you know, position something in your home, I think they're keen on that for the reasons you mentioned. Amazon is a very margin-obsessed company. One thing that kills those margins is returns, especially for big items like flat-screen TVs. And they haven't said this because they don't give numbers out a lot, but we've heard from other retailers working in e-commerce, such as Macy's, that that more informed purchase you get from the AR visualization can lead to return rates that are below 3%, which are pretty good. It varies per product category, but across the board, 3% is very good. So there's that. I think also what Amazon wants to do with mobile AR, and they've already started to experiment with this with a partnership with Snapchat, is that visualization and visual search, actually, I should say, similar to what we discussed with Google and Walmart, like being in the store aisle. Amazon obviously wants to intercept consumers when they are making buying decisions, or when you see something in the street that you like and you want to know where to buy it. I think Amazon is obviously very interested in having that visual search front end to lead you into a transaction flow through Amazon as opposed to somewhere else. So I think that that visual search play is a no-brainer for Amazon. But two interesting things happen there. One, as I mentioned, they're kind of stepping into it slowly with a partnership with Snapchat. So Snapchat has a very camera-forward audience, very AR-accustomed audience. So they're working with Amazon for Amazon's essentially their product database to do an image match whenever you do a visual search using Snap, or using Snapchat, I should say. So I think that's Amazon testing the waters. My prediction is they're going to come up with their own version of that with an Amazon native or feature within their main app to search things visually. And if you look back historically, and I know I'm probably sounding like a broken record with the historical evidence, they've actually already done this. They were out to market very early with an app that kind of flopped that was called Flow. And this was about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And really the idea then was they had this visual database of book covers. So you could go up to any book, open the Flow app, point your camera phone at it, and it would say, like, you know, that's Beowulf or, you know, whatever it is. And then it will, you know, just kind of lead you into an Amazon transaction flow. So I think they're kind of circling back to that now that the world is ready for it. And first through that partnership with Snap, and then I think, you know, natively. And that's kind of where they're going. You mentioned Sumerian too. I'll cover that briefly. I think that's very interesting. Amazon Web Services is just a beast and just financial performance. It's one of the most successful tech companies of the last decade. I bring them up because they're doing something similar to all these other players where they are applying AR in a way that drives their main business. That thread seems to just kind of go through everything. And in Sumerian's case, they realize that AR and VR and 3D experiences are going to be very compute heavy, very storage heavy, very, you know, connectivity reliant, all these things that that AWS caters to. So they want to seed their own market by putting out this like free or very cheap tool, which is Sumerian, to build these experiences. So for example, brands can build like these avatars that are the kind of like front-end customer experience UI for various points, like whether it be mobile or desktop. And so essentially, AWS, through Sumerian, wants to essentially increase its own downstream lead flow by accelerating the market for these kind of AR things that are being built and then locking people into their ecosystem. Then when they need to host it, you know, AWS is a natural kind of selection for who's ever building that stuff.
Yeah, I guess this goes back to Microsoft and the approach that they seem to be signaling, which is to really have a lot of the cloud side, everything that's happening off device. And there's been a lot of talk about, at least from the major mobile carriers, Verizon, Deutsche Telekom, and many others, about the advent of 5G and augmented reality, and smart glasses in particular, are cited as one of the key use cases, as a platform that can actually take advantage of the unique potential benefits of 5G, which is lower latency, higher bandwidth, and which suggests that more and more of the computing of that mobile device in your pocket will be pushed to the cloud. Like, oh, it's right there. It's so close, relatively speaking, from a flow of wireless data. You should do more and more in the cloud, and that would potentially serve a company like Amazon very well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So one of the less than major players, but somebody's kind of relevant here in the AR ecosystem, is Snap, right? They're clearly innovator, so much so that they serve as the new product development and testing department for Facebook and a lot of their features.
Yes.
And they've leaned heavily into augmented reality. We just talked about the partnership that they have with Amazon and the other social expression things that they're doing. Does augmented reality provide them an opportunity to play a bigger role in our lives? We saw the experimentation also that they've done with spectacles.
Yeah.
They're clearly interested. They have bigger ambitions than what they've demonstrated so far. How do you think they're going to play out based on their MO, their perspective on the world?
Yeah, so Snap is interesting. Like all these other players, they're following the money. And I think that AR flows into their business model for the same reasons we mentioned that it flows into Facebook's business model. One, kind of keeping users engaged, you know, within their walled garden. Number two, it is a format that is very conducive to advertisers, and advertisers are really starting to love it. So I think that they've seen a lot of revenue growth from their AR branded AR lenses. So they've decided to just double down on that. And you saw that most evident, I think, in their partner summit that happened a couple months ago, where they devoted a lot of it to their advancements in AR. And I think it also goes back to their kind of designation, self-designation as a camera company. I think, you know, their audience is very camera forward, and mobile AR is just very conducive to that overall kind of paradigm. But they, like I said, they're doubling down on AR. They've put a lot of kind of development muscle into a few things. One of which is, I think, a mistake they made out of the gate with AR was the lenses they had were largely just created in-house. And there was, you know, just maybe 50 or 60 of them. They've decided that they could reach a lot more scale in terms of user interest, in terms of developer creativity, by opening it up to third-party developers. So then the Lens Studio platform came out, and they kind of doubled down on that most recently by giving developers just more kind of tools to work with, making them more discoverable, giving them kind of a profile, and things like that. And on the user end, they've done a lot of interesting things where the use case has always been this kind of very fun selfie lens sort of, you know, share pictures of myself with dog ears, which is great, and it's really worked for them. But I think they want to expand the use cases and therefore expand the types of interactions that are happening, and therefore the types of products and advertisers that will pay for those types of interactions, through opening it up to the rear-facing camera. So that was one of the things that they started to do in their most recent round of announcements, was lots more capability to do things with the rear-facing camera. So that's their kind of landmarkers template, where things like the Eiffel Tower or the Flatiron Building or other just kind of landmarks can be templatized for developers to kind of build fun animations around. They also gave developers a tool to work specially with like body parts like hands and feet to augment them instead of just faces, which has been the previous MO. But other things, like it gets more towards some of those Google Lens-like things we were talking about, where it's that computer vision and machine learning fueled experience where, you know, one of the things they showed, which I thought was very cool, was, you know, point your phone at a math problem on a piece of paper, and it will kind of ingest those characters, process them, and then solve the problem for you on the fly. And, you know, that might be kind of a novelty. It might be useful in some situations, but it really just starts to make the mind wander about the types of things they can do when they open it up to the rear-facing camera. And again, not just compelling use cases, but then new types of products. Like the majority of products that they were having kind of purchase and send revenue into their bank account, what was from front-facing camera activations. But being able to do, you know, more rear-facing camera stuff means that it's just a broader range of things in the world that, that, you know, advertisers might be interested in showing off.
Yeah. How do you think their experimentation on the hardware side fits into this?
It seems so the spectacles.
Which is still a camera-first device.
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the misperceptions at the beginning was this is a set of AR glasses. And I guess that's how you define it. It's really just a set of camera glasses, as you know. But I think the interesting thing there is that, you know, it's not a pair of AR glasses, but I think in the long run, it actually becomes significant to this overall adoption and acclimation period for AR glasses. Because if you kind of boil it down to what it is a pair of glasses with, you know, some sensors and a camera. And it's either something that they're just throwing against the wall and seeing if it sticks, or it's this very intelligent, preemptive experimentation to condition users to wear, you know, mechanical or sensor infused glasses on their faces, see who's picking it up, try to get that consumer behavior conditioned. So I think that's part of one of the maybe like the hidden goals of spectacles was to just, you know, like what Apple's doing, as I mentioned, with AirPods. They've been able to prove that people will wear these things. So I think Snap is similarly experimenting with what people will put on their face and therefore how fast they should run at, you know, something that is more AR oriented.
Yeah, that'll be a really interesting one to watch.
Yeah.
On the AR side, you talked about some of the numbers over the next few years from where we are today in terms of active users of mobile AR and where we might be in a few years. So going from maybe 300 million-ish to 900 million-ish over the next handful of years. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the biggest barriers for broader adoption of mobile AR?
I think it's similar to a few of the things we've been talking about with killer apps. I think the longer that acclimation and education period for developers in which they're just kind of poking around and what works on this, what works in terms of human interactions, what's landing with consumers. I think that that's a big factor. And the longer it takes them to figure it out, that will have a big impact on consumers' interest in adopting, and therefore affect those numbers we mentioned, such as, you know, active AR use. I think some of the current use cases, we just talked about a big one, which is, you know, the selfie lenses and sharing kind of socially infused visual lenses with friends. The novelty on that could wear off, and I think it needs to be replaced with something. And I think, again, it goes back to some things that are like, you know, boring. I think boring is going to win, like mundane use cases that are more high frequency. And if you think about like the killer apps on the web, it's like, it's not sexy stuff. It's like what email, search,
news, sports news, scores, weather,
you know, social networking, you know? And so I hope that you know, if we're going to get to some of those bigger numbers and just kind of inch towards mainstream use, it's going to be some of those things that are just more boring, more mundane, but more like frequent and useful things for people, like throughout people's day.
Yeah. So as you look more broadly across everything that's happening within the AR space, what are the sorts of topics and trends that you're most interested in?
Yeah. So a few things. One of them I alluded to earlier, which is hearables. I think that it's important because it's showing the world that people are kind of putting things at least somewhere on their head in terms of conditioning that hardware use case. But one thing that's like step two in that is going to be like the either an open platform or something that is provided by Apple itself in terms of more textured overlays. Like hearables right now, like the AirPods right now, are like that first year of the iPhone where it was just like it did a few things. Like I have AirPods in my ear throughout most of the day, but 90% of the time they're inactive. And when they are active, it's when I'm either making a phone call or like, you know, let's face it, like Siri is not going to cut it in terms of like a core use case. So I think that, along those lines, I like what Bose is doing with Bose Frames, because not only is it in kind of an interesting device in terms of a pair of sunglasses that has a nifty kind of speaker near your ear that provides some of those audible types of like textured overlays, but the fact that they've made that an open platform, I think, is interesting in that, you know, we could start to see the concept and the definitions of AR broaden beyond everyone's just kind of thought that it has to be this like visual overlay to something that is more audible. And just a few of those pieces being in place: one, the hardware conditioning that Apple has proved; two, the software development and open platform that Bose is doing. I think, you know, those things kind of continuing to advance in different ways could bring us somewhere interesting. And then the second thing I'll mention that I think is just like a super interesting topic is we're starting to hear kind of these like quasi debates in the industry about, you know, what we'll end up with AR glasses and whether they will be, you know, optical systems, like what, you know, a waveguide system or what Magic Leap calls a photonic light field system, or if it's something that's like pass-through video. All mobile AR is pass-through video. As you know, it's like a camera that sends a pass-through image or video feed, and it's what you're looking at is all pixels. It's not see-through glass with a waveguide-based optical lighting system. So between those two main paradigms, there are kind of bets being made, of course, like HoloLens and Magic Leap being the kind of leaders today of AR hardware have all gone for that kind of optical system approach. And it's just interesting. I've been reading a lot lately about how pass-through video has some advantages. I mean, there's still some disadvantages, of course. You know, like, for example, the Varjo XR1 that was announced at AWE is this system where it's a VR headset. It looks just like a VR headset, but the difference is it has these two big lenses in the front that sends a pass-through image. And the difference in user experience is interesting. Just straight from a user experience perspective, that's superior in terms of AR because you have the control over all of those pixels, as opposed to optical-based AR, which is based on, like, you know, the ways that the combiner works, which has, you know, challenges in terms of, you know, lighting, how much daylight there is, and contrast ratios. But of course, that pass-through video approach right now is just so bulky because you got to wear the, you know, VR headset on your head. But like projecting forward and looking at Moore's Law and how kind of digital-based technology advances faster than optical-based technology, will that kind of video pass-through approach eventually leapfrog the optical approach down the road? And I think that I'm not taking any side. I just think it's fascinating just the advances that each of those kind of paradigms are moving towards.
Yeah, I'll take a side on this one.
Yeah, I think you will.
The video pass-through, I think, is really interesting in the short term.
Uh-huh.
And the optical see-through is the right answer longer term. But the video pass-through in the short term, as you noted, there are a couple of really great benefits from the visual experience side of things. You get true black. Mm-hmm. In an optical see-through system, black is whatever color is not being lit, right? Black is whatever the background is in the real world. But in a video pass-through system, it's essentially a VR rig, as you noted, a VR rig with cameras on the front of it. And so you're blocking all of the outside light, and you can make something that is truly black, one pixel can be truly black. The other is that you can pixel replace. So if you wanted to perceive a scene and remove a chair or remove whatever and replace it with something else, you can do that. Like, you can identify where the chair is in that scene and then erase it and fill it in with something else. And so those are super compelling characteristics from a visual experience perspective. But I think there are a couple of things that are standing in the way of video pass-through being something that's truly dominant. Actually, I'll throw out one more benefit before I even get to the negatives, in my opinion. The other benefit is that it's nearer term, in that you can already buy an Oculus Quest that has a bunch of cameras on the front of it, right? Yeah. A lot of these VR rigs have cameras on the front, and you can begin to experiment. What does it mean if I can actually see the environment and create a smart glass-like experience? Maybe I'm tracking gestures and other things. Like, what is that? I don't have a pair of controllers in my hand. And then what is that interaction now going to look like?
So developers can prototype using that type of setup, right?
Yeah, exactly. The learning curve can be accelerated with that sort of setup. But I think that a couple of challenges with the video pass-through, one is that the current technical challenge is a real one. And as you know, digital progresses pretty quickly, so maybe we'll overcome it. But with that, one big technical challenge is that it takes time for that video stream to be captured by the camera and then relayed into that display. And just doing that, Vario has really impressive video pass-through. And I think it was 15 milliseconds or so, which seems like a small amount of time, but it's actually not that small amount of time. But 15 milliseconds is the amount of time it takes to receive that video signal and then put it on the display, which is fine, but it doesn't take into account the amount of time that it you would need to identify where that couch is and erase it, right? To truly augment that video scene requires extra time on top of that 15 milliseconds, which will cause it to feel a lot more laggy and make you feel quite sick ultimately in the end. Yep. One angle, like the human factor side of it, is not great. The other is that I'm not convinced anybody actually wants to walk around with a giant brick on their face. Like, you wouldn't walk in public in that. I'm sure there are some use cases where you're fine in your living room, as you are with a VR rig, in your living room, using video pass-through in some sort of useful way. So I see it having a relatively near-term benefit, and maybe there are
And another practical point to throw on there is like eye strain from illuminated pixels.
Yeah, absolutely. Every pixel is illuminated in your eye, whereas with the see-through, even though you are getting some light from that display, it's a relatively small percentage of the overall amount of light coming into your eye. That's another great one. So I'm excited for its advancement, quick advancement in the short term. I have a hard time imagining it's going to be the standard for most spatial computing experiences long term.
Yeah, I think those are good points.
We'll see. Let's close up here with a few enlightening round questions.
Sure.
What commonly held belief about spatial computing do you disagree with?
Sure. So I kind of alluded to this, but I'll unpack it more. I think that the definition is kind of too narrow. And I think a lot of us in the industry, this is not necessarily the case, but just kind of the mainstream definition of AR is doing itself a disservice in terms of being this kind of modality where you have this kind of real world view that is augmented in some way with graphics. And I think that's great. And that's the kind of place where it's most sexy. But, you know, I talked about audible AR before. I think that's another kind of form of AR that I think is going to be important. But even going beyond that, just the kind of general sense of the physical and the digital worlds being combined. And with that broader definition, you could point to a lot of things as being AR. Shazam is AR, if you look at it that way, in terms of having external signals from the world that come in and are contextualized or processed in some way digitally, and then it results in some kind of value, right? And I think that just broader definition, one, I think can improve AR's adoption and AR's revenue opportunities beyond this just kind of one-dimensional kind of visual-based AR definition that a lot of people think of it as.
That's a good one. Of the potential uses of AR, which one are you most excited about?
Well, I think I said it before, but the boring ones, you know, like the...
Which boring one?
So I just said Shazam. I don't want to be too repetitive, but like a visual Shazam for the physical world. And I think that kind of gets back to some of the stuff we talked about with Google Lens. But I think one way to unpack that a little bit further is there was this kind of debate happening. And I think that it was this like Atlantic article about 9 or 10 years ago with this headline that was, you know, is Google making us dumb? And I think that at the time it asked that question as if like, you know, you no longer need to know facts because you can just Google everything. So, you know, why learn stuff? And I think the counter argument, which I believe is, you know, it offloads some of that just kind of rote memorization and frees up brain capacity for more just kind of intellectually stimulating and advanced thought. And that kind of concept, I think, when applied in this very kind of automated, visual or audible way in terms of just kind of learning about the world around us or contextualizing things or getting information about the objects in our physical world is very compelling beyond just kind of like something that's exciting from a UX perspective, but from a perspective of just like human evolution in terms of kind of offloading some of that brain capacity because it's this persistent kind of knowledge tool that's with us. And whether that be a pair of glasses or a pair of earbuds or holding up your phone in the current iteration of Google Lens, I think looking at it in that light and just kind of offloading some of that knowledge capacity that can be handled in this automated way is I think pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. I think about the back in the day, you have a question for your parents and they say, go look it up. Go look up in the dictionary. Go look it up in the encyclopedia. And that amount of time that it would take from when you wanted to know something until you actually knew right. It was super long.
Yeah.
And so this idea that with smart glasses being able to, as you noted, kind of understand the world, ask these questions of the world in an automated way and learn does free up our minds to do something pretty amazing. I also think a bit about the notion that biologically we're the same as we were thousands of years ago. Like you take a baby born today or a baby born in the year 1 AD and they grow up in those environments, they're going to fit their communities. It's not like that baby taken back to 1 AD that was born today is going to be smarter or not, right? It's totally dependent upon the amount of information that's around you. And so biologically we're the same, but we have all of this great foundation upon which we can now go and create and build new things. So we're smarter and more capable today collectively, cumulatively, not biologically.
Huh.
And so when I think about that and this potential, just kind of riffing on what you're just describing, if we can once again relieve ourselves of more of the mundane, we can really unlock even more of the creativity and collaboratively so as well. I think that's very exciting.
Exactly. Yeah.
What book have you read recently that you found to be deeply insightful or profound?
Sure. So first of all, as context, these days, like it's really actually hard for me to do any recreational reading. And it's not like, you know, the common excuse people give like time. It's really that I end up doing so much reading for work that like I need some other format or modality at the end of the day for anything recreational. And I listen to a lot of podcasts. But more to the question, you know, I haven't actually picked up like a novel in a while. But what I used to do, I'm a big fan of Kurt Vonnegut. And I used to read basically a book per year until I kind of ran out of Kurt Vonnegut books. And I would always do it around the holidays. And it was just like just the right amount of like science fiction and existentialism and the right dose of like tongue-in-cheek humor. And my favorite book there is probably Sirens of Titan. But the reason I bring it up now is that there was a New Yorker piece I read like 2 days ago written by Salman Rushdie, of all people, encouraging everyone to go back and read Slaughterhouse-Five, a Kurt Vonnegut novel, through today's lens. And for a few different reasons. It's really kind of, there are a lot of themes that are applicable to some of the kind of challenges in the world right now. But moreover, to really kind of like deal with the kind of escalating divisiveness in today's world with that, like, again, very just like right dose of like existentialism and tongue-in-cheek humor in terms of just like processing all of this strife in the world. But that doesn't really answer your question in terms of recent books. This may be a boring answer in terms of it being related to work, but we just published our review of Charlie Fink's Convergence. So that's very top of mind for me. And I'll state my bias there in being one of the chapter authors for that book. But one of the things that I would recommend people to pick it up, and I had a lot of fun reading it, is because it involves this, it's almost like an anthology, right? Like it's just all of these different voices on this technology. And it's kind of very meta because it does what it promises in being called convergence. And it's also like a convergence of ideas from all of these like thinkers in the AR world. And just to kind of end that thought, one thing I really liked about it, and this is right in the introduction of the book, and I think it's a great takeaway. And Charlie, you know, he goes back to this visit to the 1964 World's Fair, and he was just enamored as a child by like all of these like visions of the future. And it's all of those like comical things we always point to when we look at like the future gazing that was done in the past, like flying cars. And the other one he brings up is Stanley Kubrick's, you know, from 2001, A Space Odyssey, the video phone, which was, you know, quote unquote video phone. It was a phone booth with a video, you know, monitor in it. So I think that like his point was, you know, when we tend to view the future through the lens of the present, we tend to both underestimate, as in like the case of the video phone, but also overestimate, at least in timing, in terms of the flying car. And I think that that's, it's interesting because it's like, you know, it's kind of humbling in that, like, you know, we can't really, you know, predict the future, but it's still a valuable thought exercise for books like that, or for us all to do these things and just kind of triangulate the future in the way we think it's going to happen. And it's still just a valuable thought exercise, though in a lot of cases, we can admit to ourselves that there will be things that definitely surprise us. So that's all at once like scary and humbling, but it's also kind of liberating.
Yeah, very nice. If you could sit down and have coffee with your 25-year-old self, what advice would you share with 25-year-old Mike?
Probably buy Apple stock. I think I remember it was around that time. It was probably a little bit earlier than that, like 22 or 23. I really wanted to buy Apple stock, but I just didn't have like the liquidity. And it was at like $18 a share. but no, I would say one thing that I've learned, I think, in the last few years is to be better at time management. That kind of sounds like a boring answer, but just like don't sweat the small stuff, especially. And I've been forced into it at being like an entrepreneur with a business and all this stuff going on. There's just like so much going on. So it almost forces you into that like triage and time management. And prior to that, I wasn't forced into it, and it just, it would be a good learning for me to be able to tell myself the ways to manage time better. And then the other thing I think I probably should be my main answer is to give 25-year-old Mike my wife's phone number, my current wife's phone number, because I think it would have been fun to meet her earlier in life.
That'd be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, but that might mess up with the, you know, like the space-time continuum.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you were a different person then. Like you've grown, she's grown.
Yeah, true.
And so now might be the right time.
Maybe we wouldn't have gotten along at all.
Yeah. Right? Any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
I think we covered it. And people are probably sick of hearing my voice, but this has been a lot of fun. It's great. I keep saying the word thought exercise. Conversations like this really just kind of get things firing.
Yeah, for me too. Thank you. Where can people go to learn more about you and all the different things you're working on, including AR Insider and Artillery Intelligence and all the rest?
Yeah, the easiest place is probably arinsider.co, all one word. And it's not .com, it's .co, arinsider.co. And there's all kinds of things there. I'm also on Twitter at arinsider.
Fantastic. Mike, thanks so much for this conversation.
Yeah, this was fun. Thank you, Jason.
Before you go, I want to tell you about the next episode. In it, I speak with Kieran Hall and Reynald Wu. Reynald is the head of product management for AR at Rokid. Kieran runs strategic partner development. Rokid is a company focused on AI, robotics, and smart glasses. They announced the Rokid Glass at CES in 2018 and the Rokid Vision earlier this year. In our conversation, we talk about the company's approach to designing and developing AR smart glasses and what we can expect out of Rokid Glass and Rokid Vision when they start to ship. We get into some of the lessons they've learned and where they see the market going. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss this or other great episodes. Until next time.